Chapter 8.
This is crazy,
Joe Hardy muttered, staring around in shock. For a second, he had the irrational idea of peeking under some of the piled-up family keepsakes, as if he could uncover his mother's body that way. Joe shook his head. That would make about as much sense as accusing Con Riley and his partner, who had just entered the attic again, of spiriting Miss Hardy out the window.
She was right there,
Joe said, pointing to the chair. His voice sounded lame, even to his own ears.
Judging from the dust on the seat, I say that chair hasn't been disturbed for months,
Officer Horvath said.
Ever since that equally dusty box of Christmas lights was leaned up against it.
Joe bridled at the young policeman's snide tone, but he held back an angry answer as he looked at the box of lights. It leaned up against the back of the rocking chair, and it was just as dusty as the seat. Nobody could have sat in that chair without dislodging that box. Yet they were both there, dusty and apparently untouched.
But I saw...
Then Joe shut up. Why sound even more stupid than he did now?
You've been under a lot of pressure,
Con Riley said, in the sort of low, soothing voice people usually say for crying children or dangerous maniacs.
I couldn't say what you saw up here, but it's pretty obvious what we're seeing now. It's not a police matter.
Yet Joe caught the unspoken part of what Con was saying. If I keep making trouble, Joe thought, they'll start calling for straitjackets.
I just don't understand it,
Joe said.
Maybe you'll understand tomorrow, after a good night's sleep and when you're feeling calmer. I'll check in with you then.
In other words, Joe thought, don't call us. We'll call you. Otherwise, I get a whole new reputation as the wacky Hardy brother. Joe said very little as he showed the two police officers to the door. Officer Riley had little to say either, except for another suggestion that Joe take it easy. Feeling helpless, Joe watched the patrol car head down Elm Street. The police wouldn't listen to him now, not even Con. Joe went back into the brightly lit house. He threw himself down on the living room couch to try to sort things out. He thought about calling his father in New York, but what could he say? That he had seen his mother with a dagger in her chest, but now their body and all evidence of a murder had disappeared? Could he have imagined the whole scene he'd discovered upstairs? Sure, if he'd suddenly gone out of his mind. Maybe it had just been a very detailed dream, a nightmare. But he'd been up and around, unless he'd been sleepwalking. That just didn't seem to hold together as his theory. Joe sighed. Maybe if Frank were here, he'd come up with some brilliant piece of psychology to explain everything. And he'd know whether they should call their father or wait. He suddenly missed his brother. The phone rang, startling Joe. He picked it up and said hello.
Joe, Phil Cohen here.
Joe relaxed a little at the sound of his friend's voice.
How's it going?
I'm having an interesting time in my lab with that candle you gave me,
Phil said.
Well, then you're ahead of the police lab,
Joe told him.
They'll be interested when they get into it. According to my tests, some mighty nasty chemicals were mixed into that wax.
Phil's voice took a note of warning.
You'd better take it easy. There were hallucinogens in the wax.
You mean I might see things?
Joe said slowly.
It's possible. If I were you, I'd stick around the house for the rest of the evening.
Thanks, Phil. I appreciate that. And I promise, I'll take it easy.
Frowning, Joe hung up the phone. Could this explain the nightmarish scene he'd come upon upstairs? At least, Joe thought, he'd have something to talk about with Con Riley the next day. That would be a good thing. It would be hard to be taken seriously as a detective if you got a reputation for seeing things that weren't there. Sighing, Joe rubbed his aching head. He closed his eyes. The ringing of the phone brought him awake. Joe stared around fuzzily. Whatever they put in those candles certainly knocked the stuffing out of me, he thought. He fumbled the phone off the hook.
Hello?
He heard a familiar voice on the line. An impossible, but familiar voice.
It's midnight, Joe,
Iola said.
The witching hour. You don't listen, darling. I warned you that the dead had come for the living. You could have come quietly, but you didn't. So we've taken two for one. First Vanessa, then your mother.
The hairs on the back of Joe's neck began to prickle. How could they know about his mother if his vision of her dead body had been a hallucination? And where was his mother, anyway?
But it's you I want,
Iola said in a chilling voice.
I've always wanted you.
I don't know what you want or who you are,
Joe shouted angrily into the phone.
But if you think you're gonna play with my head, you're wrong!
I just told you what I want,
Iola said, a mocking tone in her voice.
I want you. But I always had competition, didn't I? Like that blonde girl you were hitting on right before I was killed. What was her name? Val?
Joe stood in silence, partly from amazement, partly from guilt. He had been flirting with another girl the day Iola died. But how could this voice know about that? Unless, of course, this was the real Iola. She continued the whole horrible story.
We were giving out leaflets at the Bayport Mall that day, and the last supply was in your car. I came to ask for help and found you with that girl. Do you remember what you did?
Joe didn't answer.
You said you'd be with me in a minute, and just played with your car keys.
How did she know? How?
You made a fool of me in front of that girl. So I grabbed the keys and went off to your car by myself. And you know what happened then, Joe. I set off a bomb meant for you.
Iola,
Joe said in a hoarse voice.
What are you going to say? That you're sorry? It's a little too late for that, Joe. Of course, I see you have a new blonde now. At least, you had one this afternoon.
Joe snapped out of his stunned silence.
I don't care who or what you are,
he said hotly into the phone.
If you had business with me, I'm the one you should have come to.
No,
the voice of Iola said.
You're the one I'm coming for. Soon we'll be together again, Joe. Forever.
There was a click, and Joe heard the hum of the dial tone. His hope that his troubles were all hallucinations had just been destroyed, and unless he was ready to believe in ghosts, he didn't have a clue as to what was going on.
This is crazy,
Frank said, staring around in disbelief at the torture chamber. The local sheriff stood behind him with deputies plus a contingent of state troopers. The only problem was they'd found absolutely nothing. The old madhouse was still there, but Callie's body was gone. So were the net that had entrapped Frank, the swinging blade, and the big table. Frank had led the sheriff and state troopers to the room he considered a torture chamber, but when they got there, Frank and the lawmen found only a large, empty, echoing room. In disbelief, Frank stood in the hallway, turning his flashlight left, then right. No, this was the door. This was the room.
It was right in here,
Frank said.
A heavy table with my girlfriend strapped down and a blade that came down from the ceiling.
Yep, I read that story too,
the local sheriff said. He had not been happy about being dragged away from home, and judging from the look the law officer gave the state patrol, Frank realized the sheriff probably felt he was being made a fool of by some punk kid.
Freshman year in high school. That's when I read it. Thought it was far-fetched back then. Even sillier today.
He knelt in the doorway and ran a finger through the layer of thick dust that lay on the floor.
You say you come in here, didn't you? Well, how'd you do that? By floating in midair? I guess that's it, since you left no footprints on the floor.
Frank stared in dismay at the unbroken carpet of dust that covered the stone floor of the room. The dust seemed just as thick where the table had been as it was everywhere else on the untouched floor. The sheriff was right. Except for some small scrape marks from the door, the dust hadn't been disturbed.
Next time you make up a story, son, at least try to back it up a little.
The sheriff shook his head in disgust.
Look, I'm telling you what I saw. You can check my story out. I arrived here this evening by chartered plane with my girlfriend, and now she's disappeared.
Then in 72 hours, you can declare her a missing person,
the sheriff broke in.
Till then, I'm not wasting time on some fool Halloween stunt.
He looked at his watch.
It's after 7 o'clock. What I suggest is that you take a motel room back in town, Mr. Hardy. In fact, take 2 hotel rooms in case the young lady turns up. I've had enough of this.
On the drive back to town, Frank's rented car was wedged in the middle of the procession of law vehicles. The whole parade stopped at a motel on the edge of town, and the sheriff got out and booked 2 rooms.
My advice is to stay here and out of trouble,
he said to Frank. But as soon as the police vehicles were gone, Frank was back in his car, heading for the Lazarus Clinic. He was back by midnight. The old heavy door was still ajar as Frank headed up the drive, his footsteps crunching on the gravel. The inside still looked the same as he wandered the halls, swinging his flashlight from side to side. But the place wasn't quiet. Ahead of him, Frank heard scuffling noises, footsteps. He was sure of it. At the end of a corridor and around the corner, he suddenly heard a voice.
Frank!
That was Callie.
Frank, watch out!
The voice was suddenly cut off, but Frank was already running down the hall. He turned the corner to find another corridor, also empty. Frank whirled at the sound of rusty hinges screeching behind him. One of the doors he'd passed swung open, and a man stepped out. He was tall and dark-haired, with a long, thin, expressionless face. Frank had known him first as Detective Inspector Sam Butler of the Bayport Police. Then he'd known him as Al Rosasa, one of the top terrorists working for the assassins. This is impossible, Frank thought. I saw Al Rosasa die! Unless... The assassin reached under his short leather jacket and pulled out an automatic pistol. Frank dodged around the corner. Halloween, he thought, when the dead walk. He found himself in a shorter corridor, with three branches leading into it. He could hear footsteps in two of these hallways. The footsteps were growing louder, closer. Frank broke into a sweat. He felt surrounded by invisible adversaries. His heart pounding rapidly, he started down the only hall that was silent. He turned out his flashlight, unwilling to give anyone a target. Behind him, he could hear the sounds of his pursuers. They seemed to be growing in number. Where were they when I was here with the police? Frank wondered. He was beginning to feel seriously outnumbered when he found himself stumbling into a chapel, its tall, narrow windows smashed out. Waning moonlight poured in on sagging wooden benches. The glow also illuminated a man of average height, undistinguished features, and graying hair, wearing a rumpled trench coat and standing near the altar. It was the Hardy's network contact, the Gray Man. Frank stopped in the center aisle of the chapel to catch his breath. The Gray Man had never been one of Frank's favorite people, but at that moment he was filled with relief to see the tall, serious-looking man.
You came up early after all!
Frank exclaimed.
Am I glad to see you? There's a whole bunch of terrorist types chasing me.
Without speaking, the government agent reached into his coat pocket and pulled out a pistol.
I think we're going to need a lot more than that to handle them,
Frank said.
Do you have any more agents in the vicinity?
The Gray Man didn't say a word. He raised the gun, aimed it at Frank, and fired. End of chapter.